harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ain't gonna be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me.
When you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on lightresistanceradio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, yesterday was the 13th of February. Is a very, very sad memorial, commemoration, coming as it does just before the day of hearts and Valentine's, etc. February the 13th was that day in 1945, the Second World War already being lost for National Socialist Germany, but the Allies sent over 2,000 bombers in wave after wave after wave to destroy a city named Dresden. Now,
I know people will say, well, war is war and bad things happen. And that's true, of course. It is true. Bad things happen during war. But there was something particularly hideous about this. Dresden was a cultural city, a university city, a city of arts and so on. At times it had been called the Paris of the North. It had no military value. It was not a military command center. It didn't have arms manufacturing or anything like that that would made it a legitimate target. And yes, of course, bad things happen in war. We can all agree with that. But this was particularly vile. And this attack was deliberate and concocted by Churchill. He said, among other things, this was actually at the Yalta Conference, which occurred just 6 days before. Possibly we will kill one further million in such a way, or before the war is to end. Now, see, the war was already over. Essentially, the American armies were already had already crossed the Rhine. The Soviets were pouring in from the east. It was really just a matter of months. In fact, it would be a matter of three more months, and the war would be over. And this terrible destruction was deliberately planned by Churchill, who can really only be described as a psychopath for what he did. The war's over, but he wanted to destroy Germans as a people. He even said, that this bombing raid, he wanted to baste the Germans. Now, that's a kind of an unusual turn of phrase, to baste. We talk about basting perhaps a turkey. You put usually covered with fat or something like that to improve in the baking process. It's a very, very unusual turn of phrase, but particularly psychopathic. There are wars, or at least after the Geneva Conventions, and even in the Middle Ages, there were rules of war. Traditionally, civilians were left out of the conflict. But war was fought by armies. And yes, civilians did get caught in the crossfire, of course. But that was not the norm. With the Geneva Conventions, it was agreed that people, the civilians would not be harmed. That you wouldn't target civilians. Now that doesn't mean that civilians don't get killed. Of course they do, in crossfires, in bombing of industrial areas or military targets. They do get killed. But this was deliberately targeting them. In fact, from the beginning of the war, the policy of the British was to try to destroy German civilian morale by deliberately targeting them, destroying their cities. And indeed, that's what was done. It was horrific, the destruction of German cities. The great miracle is that within 10 years of the war, Germany was completely rebuilt. I mean, it is a tremendous tribute to the survival instincts of the German people, beaten down as they were by the war, starved as they were for another year after the war was over. The Allied, or at least the British and American goals, came pretty close to genocide. Now, on that terrible night of February the 13th, 1945, bombers came over in a number of waves. The first wave dropped percussion or high-intensity bombs that would, among other things, blow off or destroy roofs. Okay. And other things. All right, that may be understandable. However, the purpose, there is a more sinister purpose, because the next wave of bombers were dropped incendiary bombs. Create these colossal fires, and there are this was concentrated. They were concentrated on the heart of the city, with the result that there was a firestorm, and that this created huge winds that sucked the oxygen
out of people's lungs. People died. They died for many causes. Some were just basically reduced to ash by the intense heat. Others were blown and smashed by the fire, by the winds created by the firestorm, or died of asphyxiation because the firestorm had sucked all the oxygen out of it. Asphalt was reduced to bubbling mass. People's limbs basically got boiled in the asphalt. It was horrible. And then there was another wave of bombing. And then when dawn came, the Allied Air Force sent in Mustang fighters flying low. And they machine gunned people that had gathered along the banks of the Elbe River to try to escape the firestorm and the heat. They machine gunned people at the zoo, gathered to those who managed to flee. This was cold-blooded murder. This was, by any reasonable definition, a war crime. A crime against humanity. And the perpetrators, particularly Winston Churchill and the head of Bomber Command, Bomber Harris, should have been in the dock at Nuremberg and should have hanged. Now, this is actually quite a leap for me, I'll tell you. I'll tell you why. I grew up as a great admirer of Winston Churchill. In fact, I was such an admirer of his that when he died in 1965, I remember going down to the in my final year of university, high school, I remember going down to the British consulate in Toronto and signing the condolence book and actually having tears in my eyes as a 16-year-old teenage boy. It took me a long time to change my mind about Winston Churchill. And there are many other things I could say negative about him, but I'm just going to leave it at that for the moment. So yesterday, I was part of a memorial, and it was the 20th year that this memorial had taken place in Toronto. And it was a memorial that was originally sponsored by the Deutsche Welte Congress, the German World Congress, formed by a former German military man, Karl Rupert. He passed away, and it's now being run by the Committee of German Expellees. These are Germans who were part of the biggest ethnic cleansing in human history. Over 16 million ethnic Germans forced out, ethnically cleansed, between 1944 and 1948 from what's called Ostpreussen, or East Prussia, West Prussia, Pomerania, Silesia, the Sudetenland, the lands of the Danube Schwabians, and so on. Anyway, this committee put on a beautiful memorial yesterday. And there's some very informative videos. A passage was read from the beginning of an excellent book called The Myth of German Villainy. I give a very brief a few remarks. And then the organizer invited people to light candles to make a couple of comments. So, one spoke of lit a candle to honor his people who had been massacred by the Czechs in the Sudetenland. Another offered his prayers for those who had been murdered by the Russians in East Prussia. And they were talking to civilians here. I made a brief comment with my candle about honoring and remembering
the men and women behind the wire, as the Irish say, are the ones who are in prison, the political prisoners, people like Alfred Schaefer, who's in prison for vigorously questioning the new religion of Holocaust, fearlessly. Another person who's in jail is Sylvia Stoltz, a lawyer who was stripped of her ability to practice law in Germany because she too vigorously defended Holocaust skeptics like Ernst Sindel. People like Ursula Haverbeck, 91 years old, a grandmother, a stately, beautiful older lady. She's in prison. Yeah, but no, not in Uganda, not in the Congo, but in Germany. For what? Did she poison her grandchildren? No. She questioned the Hollywood version of World War II, or the new religion of Holocaust, however you want to put it, and basically said that places like Auschwitz were not death camps, but were in fact work camps, labor camps. Anyway, even if she were dead wrong, what civilized country puts an old lady in prison for having a dissident political point of view? Well, I'll tell you what type of nation does that. A nation that is scared. It's frequently said, and I think very rightly, truth doesn't have to put people in jail. You don't have to jail people to secure the truth. If what you're saying or advocating is true, you don't have to put the dissidents in prison. You do have to put them in prison, though, if what you're saying is not true. Anyway, that was the purpose of my little commemoration. anyway, so there have been a number of people who've written very movingly about this, and so I'd like to read the words of several people about this, and we'll just check see about this. I'm going to go here to something written by Kevin Alfred Strom. I believe this is by him. Wrong item. Kevin Alfred Strom was a long time the head of communications for the National Alliance. He's now actually back working with the National Alliance. He had some ups and downs over the years, but he's a brilliant writer and a great communicator. And I guess I've known him for quite a long time. I'm just trying to find this item here. This is Dresden, 75 years ago today. This is not quite the item I had planned. I'll see if we can't get this up and get this the show organized and on the road. Here we are. Dresden, The Real Holocaust, and by Kevin Alfred Strom. And a Holocaust, if you're accurately speaking, and the way it's used in the Bible, is a burnt offering. So there's the idea of fire. Well, whatever happened to Jews in World War II, in general, that they were not... the accusation was not that they were put in an oven and burned to death or something like that. But that is what happened to German civilians in Dresden and other places. And Kevin Alfred Strom writes, "Every February, we remember the Holocaust of Dresden. Yesterday, I received a letter from a listener in Great Britain. who has written a poem about that day of horror and terror, and I want to share that poem with you now. On the 13th of February, 45, we roasted the women and children alive. Yet all the crazed chanting of gas chamber lies can't hide the grim truth born on terror-filled skies. God Moloch, now drunk on this surfeit of blood, took the world as his tribute and saw it. It was good. It is good that the victims are hated and shamed, that ever hereafter the truth is defamed by fables of lampshades and soap and of shoes, of diamond regurgitating escapologist Jews. It is good, said Lord Moloch, that lies must prevail, and all those that doubted be thrown in jail. It is good, quoth he, of the insatiable maw, that the world is convulsed by perpetual war. One may either be complicit in Molochian insanity or learn the truth from real history and stand up for humanity. Might not be the most facile poem, but still it gets the idea across. One of my earliest American Dissident Voices broadcasts, written and aired in 1993, was about the atrocity of Dresden. Writes Kevin Alfred Strong. The text of that broadcast has been translated into German, has been reprinted and distributed many times over the years, but the broadcast itself is seldom heard. Today, 23 years later, I present this classic broadcast once again to my American Dissident Voices audience to remember the horror and the victims of the Holocaust, of that real Holocaust. The night of February 13th and February 14th, Valentine's Day, mark an ominous anniversary in the history of Western civilization. For beginning on the night of February 13, 1945, occurred the destruction of Dresden. On the eve of Valentine's Day, 1945, World War II in Europe was nearly over. For all practical purposes, Germany was defeated. Italy and Germany's other European allies had fallen by the wayside. The Red Army was rushing to occupy vast areas of what had been Germany in the east, while the allies of the Soviets, the Britons, British, and Americans, were bombing what was left of Germany's defenses and food and transportation infrastructure into non-existence. And what of Dresden? Most of you have probably heard of Dresden, China, and that delicately executed and meticulously detailed porcelain is really a perfect symbol for that city. For centuries, Dresden had been a center of art and culture and refined leisure and recreation. She was a city of art museums and theaters, circuses and sports stadia, a town of ancient half-timbered buildings looking for all the world like those of medieval England, with venerable churches and centuries-old cathedrals gracing her skyline. She was a city of artists and craftsmen, of artists and dancers, of tourists and the merchants and hotels that served them. Above all, what Dresden was defined during the war by what she was not. She had no significant military or industrial installations. Because of this, Dresden had become, above all other things that she was, a city of children, women, of refugees, and of the injured and maimed who were recovering from their wounds in her many hospitals. These women and children, these wounded soldiers, these infirm and elderly people, these refugees fleeing from the brutal onslaught of the communist armies to the east, had come to Dresden because it was commonly believed at the time that Dresden would not be attacked. Its lack of strategic or military or industrial significance and the well-known presence of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilian refugees and even Allied prisoners of war seemed to guarantee safety to the city. Surely, it was thought, not even the most powerful and determined enemy would be so depraved and sadistic and so wasteful of that enemy's own resources to attack such a city. But the people of Dresden, who were happily attending the cinema or eating dinner at home or watching the show horses in the circus on that fateful night, were wrong, wrong, wrong. And their leaders were also wrong. For the search city was virtually open and undefended, and only minimal civil defense preparations had been made. Dresden's population had almost doubled in the months before the attack, mainly as a result of the influx of refugees from the Eastern Front. Most of them women and children. According to British historian David Irving, the briefings given to the British bomber squadrons before the attack on Dresden were curiously different. In one, the soldiers were told that their target was the railway center, Dresden. In another, they were told that the target was a poison gas factory. In yet another, they were told that the target was a marshalling grounds for troops in the city. Another was told that the target was a major arsenal. They were all lies. The only marshalling grounds for what few troops were in the area were located well outside the city. The arsenal had burned down in 1916, you know, like in the previous war. There were factories for toothpaste and baby powder in Dresden, but none for poison gas. There were, in fact, no fewer than 18 railway stations in Dresden, but only one was hit by the bombing, and that was barely touched, and in fact was operating again just 3 days later. According to copious documentation unearthed by David Irving from the archives of the American and British governments, the point of the attack was, in fact, to inflict maximum loss of life on the civilian population, and particularly to kill as many refugees as possible who were fleeing the Red Army. In achieving these goals, it was highly successful. It was thus planned and executed by those at the very, very highest levels of the British and American governments, who, to attain their purposes, even lied to their own soldiers and citizens, who to this day have never been told the full story by their leaders. How was this devastating effect accomplished? At 10:10 p.m. on February the 13th, the first wave of the attack, consisting of British No. 5 Bomber Group, began. The attack force consisted of about 2,000 bombers, with additional support craft, which dropped over 3,000 high explosive and 650,000 incendiary bombs, more commonly known as fire bombs, at the center of the city. Incendiary bombs are not known for their efficiency per pound in destroying heavy equipment, such as military hardware or railway tracks, but are extremely effective in producing maximum loss of human life. The loads carried by the bombers were over 75% incendiaries. In fact, the goal of the first wave of the attack was, according to British Air Commander Sir Arthur Bomber Harris, to set the city well on fire. That he did. The lack of any effective anti-aircraft defenses allowed the bombers to drop to very low altitudes, and thus a relatively high degree of precision and visual identification of targets was achieved. Despite the fact that they could clearly see that the marked target areas contained hospitals and sports stadia and residential areas of center city Dresden, the bombers nevertheless obeyed orders and rained down a fiery death upon the unlucky inhabitants of that city on a scale which has never before been seen on planet Earth. Hundreds of thousands of innocents were literally consumed by fire, an actual holocaust by the true definition of the word, complete consumption by fire. The incendiaries started thousands of fires, and aided by a stiff wind and the early on destruction of the telephone exchanges that might have summoned firefighters from nearby towns, these fires soon coalesced into one unimaginably huge firestorm. Now, such firestorms are not natural phenomena and are seldom created by man, so few have any idea of their nature. Basically, what happened was this. The intense heat caused by the huge column of smoke and flame, miles high and thousands of acres in area, created a terrific updraft of air in the terrific updraft of air. This created a very low pressure at the base of the column, and surrounding fresh air rushed inwards at speeds estimated to be 30 times that of an ordinary tornado. I mean, the tornado is ferocious and powerful enough. An ordinary tornado wind force is a result of temperature differences of perhaps 20 to 30 degrees centigrade. In this firestorm, the temperature differences were on the order of 600 to 1,000 degrees centigrade. This inward rushing air further fed the flames, creating a literal tornado of fire with winds in the surrounding area of many hundreds of miles an hour, sweeping men, women, children, animals, vehicles, and uprooted trees pell-mell into the glowing inferno. But this was only the first stage of the plan. Exactly on schedule, 3 hours after the first attack, a second massive armada of British bombers arrived, again loaded with high explosives and massive quantities of incendiary bombs. The residents of Dresden, their power systems destroyed by the first raid, had no warning of the second. Again, the British bombers attacked the center of the city, this time dividing their targets. One half of the bombs were to be dropped into the center of the conflagration to keep it going, the other half around the edges of the firestorm. No pretense whatsoever made of selecting military targets. The timing of the second armada was such as to ensure that a large number of the surviving civilians would have emerged from their shelters by that time, which was the case, and also in hopes that rescue and firefighting crews would have arrived from surrounding cities, and that also proved to be true. The firefighters and medics thus incinerated hadn't needed the telephone exchange to know that they were needed. The firestorm was visible from a distance of 200 miles. It was reported that body parts, pieces of clothing, tree branches, huge quantities of ashes and miscellaneous debris from the firestorm fell for days on the surrounding countryside as far away as 18 miles. After the attack finally subsided, rescue workers found nothing but liquefied remains of the inhabitants of some shelters, where even the metal kitchen utensils had melted from the intense heat. The next day, Ash Wednesday and Valentine's Day 1945, medical and other emergency personnel from all over central Germany had converged on Dresden. Little did they suspect that yet a third wave of bombers was on its way, this time American. This attack had been carefully coordinated with the previous raids. 450 flying fortresses and support contingent of fighters arrived to finish the job at noon. And he says, I quote from David Irving's The Destruction of Dresden, "Just a few hours before, Dresden had been a fairy tale city of spires and cobbled streets. Now total war had put an end to all that. The ferocity of the U.S. raid on the 14th of February had finally brought the people to their knees. But it was not the bombs which finally demoralized the people. It was the Mustang fighters which suddenly appeared low over the city, firing on everything that moved. One section of the Mustangs concentrated on the riverbanks, where masses of bombed-out people had gathered. British prisoners who had been released from their burning camps were among the first to suffer the discomfort of machine-gunning attacks. Wherever columns of tramping people were marching in or out of the city, they were pounced on by the fighters and machine-gunned or raked with cannon fire." Now, this is mass murder of civilians. Ladies and gentlemen, on this program, it was actually Kevin Alfred Strom, I can give you only a bare glimpse of the inhuman horror of the Holocaust of Dresden. In Dresden, no fewer than 135,000 innocent victims died, with some estimates as high as 300,000. Actually, this is pretty much the estimate today. More died in Dresden than died in the well-known attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which would occur a few months later. More destruction befell Dresden in one day than it was inflicted on the whole of Britain during the entire war. And yet, you haven't been told, have you? One of the much suppressed stories of World War II. Well, I'm going to entirely change track right now. And a place signed by a very good friend of mine, Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson, is a very devoted Christian woman who's actually putting her freedom on the line for something she's involved in. This is Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson. And it's the trans horror.
I'm following up on an interview that I put up yesterday regarding a father and his child who is transitioning. I'm grateful for the support of USA-based activist mummy Elizabeth Johnson and Marika Ramsey, political posting mama from Australia, to help us spread the word on this absolutely astounding failure of our society to protect a minor. Thank you also for the support of many others that I've been in contact with in the last 12 hours as a brewing situation is developing. At 9 p.m. last night, obviously lawyers work at all hours, I received a letter requesting that I take down my video as I am in violation of a publication ban It stated it restricts publication of information that could identify family members and medical professionals involved in the case. They attached an order of Mr. Justice Bowden, which includes the initial publication ban prohibiting publication of information that would identify family members, and the entered order of Madam Justice Mazzari prohibiting publication of the healthcare professionals. I wonder if healthcare professionals are doing the right thing, why we would have to hide their names. They further state and want me to confirm that I will comply and remove all copies of the videos that I've posted on my social media, all sites. And if I do not cooperate with this, then they may proceed to seek an order in the BC Supreme Court on an urgent basis this week. Well, so I've done a lot of soul searching overnight throughout the day. I've spoken with legal counsel and dear friends whom I trust. The advice I have received has ranged from you need to comply completely, avoid all costs to myself, and then there are those who say it's time to stand. More than anything, I've had to wrestle with myself, with my conscience, with what I can live with. In the face of this travesty of justice, this assault on common sense, parental rights, and the absolute failure to protect a precious youth in our nation who has been used as a pawn for an agenda that will not be fully understood until they are in their adult years, I have asked myself, am I going to bow to this establishment that wants all of this kept quiet so that they can keep hurting families and other children? Since embarking on this battle of a lifetime against the indoctrination of our kids with gender theory, I have paid a very high price to stand against this unspeakable evil. 3 years ago, I had not even heard of this ideology, and neither had any of my peers. Then we came to find out there were dozens and dozens and dozens of transgender indoctrination books in our public school system. Books that were teaching our kindergartners, while parents were in a happy place believing that their kids were safe at school, kids were being told, little Johnny and our little girls were being told that they could change their gender and their sex and they could be a different person on the inside than they are on the outside. Do you know that there is now a 4,500% increase worldwide in gender clinic referrals and no end in sight? Rather than being punk rockers and goth and maybe even emo, sadly, teenagers now struggling with their identity have now fallen victim to a global agenda telling them that they can change their sex. Science will tell you it's not possible, and sound thinking will tell you that this is madness. Yet there is a group of activists hell-bent on telling kids that they can be the opposite sex in their head as they are in their body, and that they should use cross-sex hormones and gender-affirming surgery, which will irreparably remove healthy breasts from females and genitalia from males. There is no reversing this. As I have exposed this darkness to the light, I have been targeted by LGBTQ activists, and I stress the activists because many in that community stand with me. I've lost my job, and I have had to define for myself what it means to have courage in a land where we seem to be unable to face this giant. In the story that I put forward yesterday, the education, medical, and judicial systems have collaborated to embolden and enable a minor who cannot legally get a tattoo or drink a glass of wine. This minor is able to pump their body full of pharmaceuticals that must be taken for the rest of their lives. These drugs have now caused sterility and stunted lifelong bodily functions in their most private areas, and now we as a society are asked to never talk about it. Parental rights have been eviscerated, and the state has seized control of our children. Whether you know it or not, Canada, this means that your voice as a parent, it no longer matters. These are the pertinent issues in this case that I presented yesterday. This person that has been transitioned and is being transitioned had heterosexual feelings. The doctors made a diagnosis within 2 hours of meeting the child that would change their entire world and invoke ramifications that will last the rest of their lives. The school failed to notify the parents of the child's confusion even after changing their name in the yearbook. The courts have now declared that doctors are the final say. These activist doctors have been caught on tape telling parents to use the suicide word if they are not getting their kids transitioned fast enough. Doctors who have hundreds, if not thousands, of kids in our Canadian foster care system now transitioning all the kids who come through their door. Studies show that up to 90% of children who express a discordant gender identity will come to identify with their bodily sex if natural development is not interfered with. The world's first detransitioning conference has now taken place, with attendees expressing deep regret at body mutilation and the lies that they were told to get them there. We have activists like transsexual Morgane Ogre, who has rape shelters defunded for only accepting real women. You can find pictures with Morgane and Trudeau and Conservative Party Michelle Rempel, who supports the Ogre Foundation and MCs their events to help transgenders obliterate the rights of women. Ogre believes it's important for schools to keep confidential info from parents to protect kids from parents, then makes this erroneous comment that schools have kept things confidential from parents for decades and decades. Well, they certainly didn't do that when I was a kid. I was always in trouble with my parents because the school was telling them all the bad stuff I was doing. Whatever happened to protecting the role of a parent? These activists celebrate the silencing of this story, as in this tweet where Morgane says, "Welcome news for minors seeking medical treatment despite parental objection for an abortion, contraception, vaccination, or in this case, hormone replacement therapy. A relief, my warnings to Laura Lynn Thompson and Carrie Simpson, they were playing with fire, proved true." So this is what the entire establishment believes, is that we are playing with fire if we dare to speak out on this. The furnace is heating up. My Twitter account has now been suspended until I remove this tweet. Apparently, Twitter is an open forum for pedophiles to chat it up, but I can't talk about the protection of children. So I've weighed this moment heavily. There are a few times in life when you must do what is right and not what is easy. There are moments when something is so evil and insidious that if you remain silent or you bow to the establishment, you will have to live with the cowardice of your soul. And that, I cannot live with. Activists are using their trusted positions of authority and pushing an agenda to normalize something that is so vile, so radical, so totalitarian, so unconstitutional that it is causing irreparable permanent harm to minors. We cannot be silent. This agenda to sterilize and mutilate children is in violation of Section 2, Section 7, Section 15 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, as well as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Every part of this grotesque agenda is fueled by extremists who have infiltrated key positions and are working together to silence opposition. Well, I, for one, will not be silenced. This father's story must be heard. It could be your child. I will not comply with this request from the lawyers to remove the video. You can now find it at BitChute at a link in the description below. I will post it on all my social media platforms, and I urge you to download it for yourself and embed it in your own channels. I'm here to say today, this far and no further. We have people who are rising up and saying, we will not be silent any longer. This cannot be stopped. You cannot force us to be silent in the face of this atrocity. You just can't. What am I to do? To just bow to this? To not stand? To not fight? I think it's time to stand. I can't believe the people that are silent on this, the people in our political establishment, political parties caving into this. It's all about the LGBTQ pride parades. Nobody wants to voice on conversion therapy bans that are going in that would not facilitate help for a child like this and in fact have prevented help for this child in this story, I am not going to be quiet. You cannot make me be quiet. I did not come to this world to lack courage when there is something so wrong right in front of me, and I will not do it. This is a decision that we all have to make for ourselves, what our calling is, how to do this, how to proceed. I just know for me, I had to really talk it over with my loved ones, with counsel. You know what I think? I think it's time where we say, this far and no further. Leave the kids alone. Stop it. As an adult, you can do anything you want in this beautiful land, but you cannot mess with children and expect the mums and the dads and the grandmas and the grandmas to be silent.
That's a Laurel and Tyler Thompson, a very brave Christian lady who's interviewed the father of a 15-year-old girl that is being transitioned into a boy against his wishes, against his counsel. He was told by one judge that if he did not call his seriously messed up daughter, she's four suicide attempts, has slashed herself, really a seriously disturbed young lady. If he does not call her by her proper pronoun, which proper in political correctness would be he, and by her new name, whatever it is, this will be defined as family violence. No, violence, you know, as in punching somebody, and he'll could go to jail. That's been before the courts, and she interviewed him, and it's exposing what's been going on. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. I'm going to take something perhaps a little more cheerful. And this is some German drinking music. And this is Paul Fromm. And you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Fighting side of me, back with the game tomorrow, same time on altrighttv.com. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes, and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.